Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We are, what, 6 days out from the Mueller report? And I wanted to talk to somebody who has been covering this Russia investigation really from the beginning. And we're joined by Natasha Bertrand, who is now with Politico, national security correspondent for Politico. Good to have you with us, Natasha.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's first of all talk about how long you have been covering this. This is like your third iteration. You've been covering Trump and Russia since when?
Since 2016, since the shenanigans first began, when I was at Business Insider. And then I covered it for them throughout 2017, switched to The Atlantic to cover it 2018. And now I am at Politico covering the same thing.
So you're a veteran, you're a 2 week veteran of Politico.
Yes. Now, you just made
the, so how is Politico different from The Atlantic?
It's, you know, a faster pace. It is, higher metabolism. It is more news oriented rather than big picture analysis oriented. So with my love of news, it's a perfect fit.
No, I mean, I love The Atlantic, but I do sort of picture them sitting around thinking deep thoughts and smoking pipes and stuff, which is not the image that I have of the Politico newsroom.
And
of course, you've been covering this, but also you are a contributor to MSNBC. Speaking of which, and I'm going to confess, this is going to be the second day in a row I mentioned Game of Thrones, so I should apologize. I'm going to confess that I watched Game of Thrones, but I did go back to watch your appearance on Ari Melber's special, which was opposite Game of Thrones on Sunday night. And you did something very interesting. You went through a series of questions that the Mueller report did not answer. And I've been focused, of course, plowing through the 448 pages and trying to, figure out all the things that it, did find. But you point out a number of big storylines that were really not addressed, starting with things like, for example, Cambridge Analytica and the role they played, not much of a mention. The role of the NRA and the Russian money. So, can you walk me through some of the things that you were looking for that you did not find?
Yeah, definitely. So this is actually one of the main areas that I've been intrigued by, which is the lack of any mention on certain aspects of this investigation that it had been reported previously did catch Mueller's eye and were being investigated by him. So a big one, of course, as you mentioned, is Cambridge Analytica. It's a data mining firm that the Trump campaign hired in 2016 to help it essentially target ads. The company didn't appear once in the report, but Mueller had questioned and subpoenaed former employees, ostensibly in an effort to understand whether they had any foreign connections or whether, they had any ties to WikiLeaks, because the CEO of Cambridge Analytica did actually reach out to Julian Assange in 2016, asking him if he could help sort through any of Hillary Clinton's emails that Assange might have. So kind of weird subplot there that was never quite resolved. And then there's the NRA.
Let's talk about the Cambridge Analytica, because I was focused on them really from the beginning and actually did think that they were going to be at the nexus of this. So do you have any theory about why they're not in this? Is it possible that that's part of the counterintelligence investigation that we still don't know a lot about?
Yeah. I think that that's a possibility. It could also be part of one of the, many criminal referrals that Mueller made to other offices. Perhaps he realized that this really didn't have a nexus to the Russia investigation itself. Maybe Cambridge Analytica didn't have any overt ties to the Russians and what they were doing in terms of the social media disinformation and propaganda campaign. So he referred it. That's, of course, total speculation. Another possibility is that he just kind of let it go and it wasn't really, a thread worth pursuing anymore for his team. But regardless, it's, given how much it was mentioned in the same breath as the attack by the Russians on the election and the role that big data and, advertising and, illicit disinformation campaigns played, you would think that he would at least include a line saying, we looked into this, we didn't find anything, as he did on several other subjects in the report, but there's nothing there.
Okay, the NRA.
Yeah, so this is another really interesting thread. The NRA had been investigated, according to multiple reports, for potentially laundering money into the Trump campaign from Russia. And it was reported that, you know, Mueller was kind of poking around on the subject. He had asked Sam Nunberg, who's a former Trump campaign advisor, about the campaign's relationship with the NRA and the circumstances of a speech that Trump gave to the group in 2015. And they actually continued, Mueller's team continued asking witnesses about the campaign's ties to the NRA as recently as December of 2018. And then there's also, you know, the July indictment of Maria Butina, mm-hmm. who was, you know, a Russian national who tried to infiltrate the NRA. So they were thinking perhaps there was some, you know, weird kind of money moving between her and the Russians into the gun rights group. But, you know, there was never any solid, you know, concrete finding as to whatever happened in that investigation. And Mueller did not mention the NRA once in the entire report.
Okay, the Alpha Bank server mystery.
That is a very complicated and, you know, convoluted area, but essentially there were these weird contacts between a Russian commercial bank called Alpha and the Trump Organization servers throughout 2016. I believe it was through May, from May through September of 2016. And that pinging, the lookups that the Alpha Bank did for the Trump Organization were deemed suspicious by cybersecurity researchers and former government officials who have looked at this stuff, you know, very deeply in the past. And, you know, the FBI investigated it and apparently concluded back in October, and I think it was November of 2016, that there was an innocuous explanation for the server activity, like marketing or spam. But that was never really, you know, that was never really a conclusion that anyone drew in a comprehensive and formalized way. And it was not addressed in the Mueller report either. The only thing that was, that's kind of related, is the contacts that Peter Ovan, who's the co-founder of Alpha Bank, tried to have at Putin's behest with the campaign after Trump was already elected.
Okay, the next two that you mentioned seem a little bit more, even more consequential. Carter Page and what he was up to in Moscow, and Paul Manafort handing that political data. Let's start with Carter Page. The Mueller investigation, Mueller report essentially says, yeah, we weren't able to crack this. We don't know what Carter Page was doing in Moscow.
Yeah, and after, what was it, I think 4 renewals of the FISA warrant that was granted to the FBI to monitor his communications, they still could not determine, you know, what he was doing in July of 2016, who he met while he was there. And this was a very, you know, consequential and pivotal moment for the campaign. It was right before just before the Republican National Convention. Carter Page was apparently meeting with high-level campaign officials or high-level government officials when he was in Moscow. But this all links back to the dossier, right? The famous Steele dossier. What the dossier said was that Carter Page was there in order to discuss, you know, a stake in Rosneft, which is the biggest, you know, Russian energy company, and the sale of that stake in exchange for sanctions relief. Well, Carter Page actually did acknowledge to Mueller that the sale of that stake in Rosneft was mentioned, and that he did meet with various officials to discuss the sale. So that is a portion of the Steele dossier that's at least been partially corroborated now. You know, and the fact that Mueller could not determine what else actually happened when he was there may even help the dossier's case a little bit more, just in terms of, you know, his inability to fill in the details, but his also inability to completely repudiate the dossier.
Yeah, let's talk about this. So, you know, how should we be thinking about the dossier? Because the Steele dossier is really not mentioned much in the Mueller report, and certain aspects appear to be refuted. So how do you think about the Steele dossier right now?
You know, looking through the report, I actually saw numerous instances where it was bolstered or even corroborated. So the Carter Page instance is one. And then another is where, you know, in the dossier, it actually says that Alpha had a good relationship with the Russian president, with Vladimir Putin, throughout 2016. And that the co-founder of Alpha Bank was actually meeting with Putin and Mueller's report actually said that the co-founder of Alpha was meeting with Putin on a regular basis. And then Putin actually ordered him to go and make, you know, good connections with the Trump transition team. So that is something that Alpha was apparently fighting. They've, you know, launched litigation to because they claimed that the Steele dossier defamed them by saying that they had this kind of quid pro quo type relationship with the Kremlin. But in fact, Mueller corroborates that, hey, in fact, they did have a good relationship in which they were doing favors in both directions. So the broad outlines of, you know, the report, I think, support the main contention of the dossier, which is that, you know, the Trump campaign knew that the Russians were helping them and they accepted that help without necessarily getting into a criminal conspiracy with the Russians, but they certainly did not discourage it. And the Russians were at the same time trying to elect Donald Trump. But, you know, another aspect of the report, which is a little bit unclear, is whether or not Michael Cohen was actually in Prague, which is a main contention of the dossier. The Mueller report says that Michael Cohen told the special counsel that he wasn't there, but Mueller never actually makes any independent determination. So that's kind of an intriguing little plot.
Yeah, you would think they'd be able to get to the bottom of that. But really, no P tape, though. The P tape was not corroborated. So we didn't get the P tape.
Well, Charlie, I just want to, there's in a footnote, they actually say that in, I believe it was, October of 2016, Michael Cohen received a text message from a Georgian businessman who told him that he had managed to stop the flow of tapes coming out of Moscow and that the Trump campaign should not worry about them any longer. The Georgian businessman then told Mueller's office that the tapes were fake, but he did not tell Michael Cohen that the tapes were fake. So, you know, there's still an open question there as to whether, you know, the tapes, if they do exist, are real. But again, Mueller's report did not really draw judgment on, you know, whether they exist and the veracity of them. But it does mention them, and it does mention that there's this weird, you know, conversation about them that wasn't previously reported.
I was always skeptical about that because and this is one of the very few instances where I do actually credit Trump's comment that he's a notorious germaphobe. Would he have engaged in that kind of behavior? I really don't know. Okay, so we're still on this. Questions not answered here. Paul Manafort, I really thought that the whole Paul Manafort, the story about Paul Manafort handing detailed polling data to someone in Russia, that was going to be a major part of this investigation. But as you point out, that's not answered, really.
Yeah, that is actually another area where Mueller said that he was unable to determine the motivations behind Paul Manafort giving Kolomnik the polling data. You would think that is the one area that is potentially a, you know, smoking gun in the collusion and conspiracy case, because it's just so blatant and he's giving it to someone who is suspected of having ongoing ties to Russian military intelligence. But because Manafort lied so often and lied during his cooperation deal with Mueller and was actually still in a joint defense agreement with the Trump team, even while he was cooperating with Mueller, they weren't able to get the full story, and encrypted communications didn't help, you know, an inability to get Kolomnik himself to flip on this didn't help. And apparently Rick Gates's cooperation didn't help either. So that's really an ongoing mystery. But all we know for sure, what Mueller says, is that, you know, at least one motivation he had was to try to convince the Ukrainians, at least, that he could have, you know, that he was still capable of getting someone elected, that he was still in the game, and that the polling showed that Trump was actually doing better than anyone in the United States thought.
Yeah. See, I mean, I always thought of that this really was at the centerpiece of any possible conspiracy, that you would give the targeted polling data to someone, some Russian, who would then use that, whether the data was from Cambridge Analytica or whatever, then use that to target the misinformation to these key voters in places like Wisconsin and Michigan, where the election, in fact, was determined. But obviously, you needed Paul Manafort's cooperation, probably, or that would have certainly help to make that case. But, you know, this now goes to the question of obstruction of justice, that in fact Paul Manafort's refusal to cooperate would suggest that some of the tactics perhaps some of the tactics that the president had used to dangle pardons or to influence witnesses in some way turned out to be effective. That, in fact, this is an area where Bob Mueller was unable to get to the truth because there were witnesses who refused to cooperate with him.
Right. I think that's right. And one of the more intriguing parts of the report also is where, you know, Mueller says that he actually names Rudy Giuliani as he implicates Rudy in the potential obstruction part of the investigation by saying that Rudy was on TV dangling pardons for Paul Manafort and saying that nothing was off the table. So that's a really interesting part of this, because Rudy is the only lawyer for Trump who is mentioned by name in the report. All the others, John Dowd, Jay Sekulow, are not identified by name. But this clearly is something that unnerved Mueller, especially given, as I mentioned before, Manafort's decision to stay in the joint defense agreement with Trump, even while he was engaging in cooperation with the special counsel, which is virtually unheard of.
Okay, I want to move on to the second piece. You have a comprehensive piece in Politico, What You Missed in the Mueller Report, and it's a triple byline. Darren Samuelson, who's also been all over this investigation, Kyle Cheney, and you. Walking through this, you went back into this report and the 2,000-plus footnotes to come up with some details that I'm guessing people had glossed over because there's so much in this. So let's just walk through all of this. So let's start with who did not get prosecuted and why is that interesting?
Yeah, so then Attorney General Jeff Sessions, he actually avoided a perjury prosecution over his Senate confirmation testimony, in which he told lawmakers that he had no communications with the Russian government during 2016. It actually later came out that he did meet with Sergei Kislyak, the Russian ambassador to the U.S., on multiple occasions. And we actually didn't realize, I don't think, before this report came out, that investigation into possible perjury by Sessions had been taken over by Mueller's team. But they looked at the January 2017 exchange that Sessions engaged in and, you know, written follow-up responses that Sessions submitted to lawmakers. And they determined that, you know, the meetings that he had with Kislyak in 2016 weren't sufficient to prove that he gave knowingly false answers, because basically it's believable that Sessions might not have remembered his interactions with Kislyak during the election. And then there's, you know, Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, and Paul Manafort, who all escaped prosecution for their role in the Trump Tower meeting in June 2016. And essentially, Mueller's office said that they looked into whether they should face charges for violating laws banning foreign campaign contributions, but ultimately opted against pushing for indictments out of concern that a conviction wasn't a sure thing, that they might not be able to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. So the evidence was certainly there. They just didn't think that it reached the bar, the very high bar that Mueller has set. You know, he wants to win cases, which is understandable. So they acknowledge that they lacked evidence to prove, essentially, that they acted with general knowledge of the crime they'd be committing by meeting with the Russians and getting that information, and said that, you know, the opposition research that was promised to them also wouldn't necessarily qualify as even as an illegal donation, because it is unclear whether that was a thing of value, because it's unclear, you know, what they were even expecting. And it's also unclear what they actually got out of the meeting, which is very little, apparently.
I also thought this was interesting on the whole hacking front. You point out that they apparently considered filing charges against an unnamed defendant for trafficking in stolen property. That's buried in a footnote. So we don't know who that was. Was that possibly Roger Stone? We don't know.
Don't know. I mean, we have no idea. This could be something, you know, having to do with like complex computer crimes, perhaps.
Who knows,
it could be anything. It's an interesting footnote.
This next one is very interesting. We found out that Don Jr. had refused a voluntary interview with Mueller, which is, of course, interesting because the president has been tweeting out about it. We were all willing to talk with him. But Don Jr. is all over the Mueller report, you know, the Twitter feed, messages, interviews. But he refused to sit down with the special counsel.
Yeah, yeah. And we still don't know whether he actually told, his lawyers told the special counsel that he would assert his Fifth Amendment rights, you know, against self-incrimination, and that he would therefore refuse to testify. And in that case, Mueller would not have kind of perp walked him into the office and forced him to invoke his Fifth Amendment rights. That's not really what prosecutors do. They usually just drop it if a defendant says that they're going to invoke the Fifth. So that there may have been, you know, a subpoena fight in which Trump Jr. conveyed that, and ultimately Mueller just didn't think that it was worth the fight. But we still don't know. And I think it's ironic that, you know, the president was tweeting yesterday about how the special counsel didn't interview anyone close to him who was, you know, interacting with the campaign or knows the president personally, you know, while at the same time we learned from Mueller's report that Trump Jr., his son, actually refused to be interviewed.
Yeah. So who is Annie Donaldson?
Annie Donaldson is the chief of staff to the former White House counsel, Don McGahn. And she actually took some of the most critical notes during all of the obstruction episodes that were, you know, under investigation by Mueller. And her memos document in really vivid detail the chaos inside the West Wing as Trump raged about the Russia probe and raged about Jeff Sessions recusing himself and raged about Mueller taking over. There was a White House counsel's meeting on March 2nd of 2017 that she memorialized, which really stands out. And she says that, you know, there were serious concerns about obstruction. She actually put that in quotes with regard to Trump's efforts to get Sessions to essentially unrecuse from the Russia investigation. So after Jim Comey was fired, later that year, she basically said that, you know, this could be a serious, serious problem for him. This could be, you know, potentially the end of his presidency, because if there's ever going to be an obstruction of justice investigation, it's going to center around this one episode. And in fact, it did.
And she actually wrote down POTUS in panic/chaos. Need binders to put in front of POTUS, all things related to Russia. That's that is pretty graphic. Well, this is why the president, of course, doesn't think that lawyers should be taking notes. Okay, so the next one is the degree to which Mueller's investigation was hampered by missing and deleted messages.
Yeah, this is a big one. So the going dark issue, it was, you know, really a big problem with regards to Paul Manafort. And it was also a problem with regard to you know, Steve Bannon and Eric Prince, particularly with regard to Eric Prince's meeting in the Seychelles after the election with this high-level associate of the Kremlin named Kirill Dmitriev. So both Eric Prince and Dmitriev, and I believe Steve Bannon as well, claimed that they had just lost all of their records of communication about that meeting.
Sure.
Which, of course, was a very consequential meeting, because it's the head of Russia's sovereign wealth fund meeting with, you know, a top Trump advisor who, you know, he is an informal advisor, but he's still pretty influential in the campaign. He's communicating with Steve Bannon on a regular basis. So this really hampered Mueller's efforts to get to the intent question in a lot of instances. And of course, as we discussed before, it also impeded his ability to get more information about why Manafort gave over that polling data.
Yeah. And those of us who are Russian obsessives about this had always wondered about what was the meeting in the Seychelles between Eric Prince and the Russians. What is the possible innocent explanation for that? And I guess we're not going to find out the answer. I want to skip over a couple of ones. It turns out there was a second scope memo, the scope of the investigation that we did not know about.
Yeah, this was really interesting, and it's something that kind of spawned conspiracy theories among Republicans over the last year who were intent on investigating the investigators. But essentially, you know, there was an August 2017 document from Rod Rosenstein, who's the deputy attorney general, that explained the contours of Mueller's probe. And Mueller's team had privately disclosed a version of that memo to a federal judge who was presiding over Manafort's trial in Alexandria, Virginia last summer. And the Republican lawmakers really wanted to see it because they thought that it was, you know, a further expansion of Mueller's jurisdiction that just wasn't warranted. Then, you know, there was the second scope memo after that in October 2017 that cleared the way for particular investigations into Roger Stone, Michael Cohen, and Rick Gates. and authorized Mueller to specifically probe Michael Cohen's use of an LLC to receive funds from Russian-backed entities. So that's a very specific purview that was given to Mueller that we didn't actually know about. We kind of knew that he was looking at this, you know, Cohen's use of the LLC to, do lobbying campaigns on behalf of foreign entities, on behalf of, you know, different companies in the U.S. to lobby the president. So that was actually specifically authorized in that memo. And then separately, the memo approved investigations in two individuals who were considered, you know, in league with his original targets. So, you know, Manafort, et cetera, and Papadopoulos, et cetera. So basically, the last thing it did was it transferred that Sessions investigation, perjury investigation, to Mueller, which is what we discussed previously.
Okay, now this is a big one. What we found, the big question was, what is the status of this FBI counterintelligence investigation? And we really did find out what the partnership between the Mueller investigation and this FBI counterterrorism investigation. As you point out, this was one of the big mysteries of Mueller's work, is what was going to happen with the intelligence findings. So what is going to happen? It seems like we got an answer that this report was not going to deal with that investigation, but it raises the question. So what's going on, and what possibly are we going to find out in the future?
Yeah, so this is pretty big. This is confirmation of what sources had been telling me for months now, which is that Mueller's investigation was first and foremost, if not exclusively, a criminal investigation, not a counterintelligence investigation, even though the mandate that appointed him did include, counterintelligence language and did authorize him to conduct that kind of investigation. He is obviously a very by the books prosecutor, very old school, and he pursued this, you know, as a prosecutor would. So what he revealed in his report when describing what he did do with certain counterintelligence findings that he felt were better, could be better handled by another entity, is that he handed them over summaries of foreign intelligence and counterintelligence information that he and his team had established throughout the course of their probe to FBI headquarters and FBI field offices. So basically, a lot of the sensitive national security intelligence information that he may have collected that may not have informed charging decisions that he actually made, or may not have been useful to understanding those charging decisions, he gave to the FBI. So the idea now is that perhaps there is an ongoing counterintelligence probe being carried out by the FBI into, you know, Russia's ongoing interference, into, you know, potentially members of Trump's orbit. And, you know, the idea has been floated before that, you know, did the FBI ever really stop investigating the president himself as part of a broader mm-hmm. counterintelligence probe? That, of course, would raise really, really thorny issues, because obviously the president is the commander in chief, is the head of everything, is the head of the executive branch. So how would you have a counterintelligence investigation into someone who is, you know, able to have ultimate control and authority over those investigations? We don't know, but it's safe to say that all of the findings that Mueller handed over have not been, you know, put in a file somewhere and closed forever. I think that those files are very much still open.
Yeah, the line that jumped out at me from your piece was, it's a brief glimpse into the Bureau's work, but it could open vast new chapters of Russia intrigue for Congress, where Democrats have demanded briefings on the classified counterintelligence findings of Mueller's team and the FBI. So that is not done. Okay, so tell me about this weird story about Michael Cohen and the Olympic weightlifter.
Right. So we had actually thought that Michael Cohen was communicating with a former Russian Olympic weightlifter in December of 2015. But in fact, it was not. It was a Putin operative who had, I guess, a similar name or the same name. His name is Dmitry Klokov. And he was a former aide to Russia's energy minister. He's the director of a large Russian electricity transmission company. And he reached out to Cohen via his wife, who first reached out to Ivanka Trump. Ivanka then forwarded the email to Michael Cohen, and he got in touch with the husband, Dmitry. And they were discussing a potential meeting between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin that may have been tied to Trump's broader efforts to build a Trump Tower Moscow in late 2015, early 2016. Ultimately, those talks went nowhere, according to Mueller, because Michael Cohen was already in talks to build a Trump Tower in Moscow with Felix Sater, who's a Russian, a Soviet-born developer.
Kind of a sleazy figure.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is what happened in the more interesting thing to my in my opinion is what happened in July of 2018, which is when Kolokov's ex-wife, the one who reached out to Ivanka Trump in the first place, emailed Mueller's office in an unsolicited way.
So weird.
And claimed that her husband had asked her to reach out because Russian officials wanted to offer Trump land in Crimea, as well as an unofficial meeting with Putin. So there were clearly some interesting calculations going on, you know, among Russian officials as early as December of 2015 on how best to essentially bribe the president into, making Crimea, if he were to be elected, making Crimea be up for grabs by the Russians.
So you have obviously immersed yourself in all of the details and the characters and the issues and the events. Were you disappointed by the Mueller report? Did you think that he dropped the ball, that he didn't pursue storylines that you thought were promising? What grade would you give the Mueller report?
I wasn't disappointed. I think, I was more confused that certain things weren't resolved, particularly, the Cambridge Analytica question, the NRA question, the Prague question, the AlphaGate question. I mean, it seemed to a lot of, observers of the Mueller investigation over the last 2 years that the wrapping up of the probe was premature. And there has been no explanation yet as to why Mueller felt the need to wrap it up with all these outstanding questions, with Roger Stone's trial yet to be even completed, let alone started. It's going to happen in November of this year, before Rick Gates's cooperation actually ended. And that I think is the biggest question that I still have, which is, was there any pressure applied to wrap up the investigation? Why wasn't there any, concrete decision made on the obstruction question? We got a glimpse of that in the report. He mentioned the OLC memo, which would make it unfair for him to actually say one way or the other whether he planned to charge the president with obstruction. But I think that Mueller coming to the Hill and testifying, which is what the Democrats really want him to do, might go a long way in clearing up some of those questions. And maybe he can say something about, where these different threads ended up.
Because that was surprising to me going through your stuff, was to realize how many loose ends there still were, and his admission that I was not able to resolve this, I was not able to answer this question, and yet they ended this investigation. One of the reasons why I was skeptical, and I think I'm not going to speak for him, but I think Ben Wittes was also skeptical that this was all wrapping up, was the fact that they had not interviewed Don Jr. So it came as a surprise to me that they had wrapped this up without actually talking with him. The question, of course, will be, which we won't know, is whether Bob Mueller would be willing to say to Congress that, in fact, he wished he had more time, or that there was some kind of a pressure of some sort. Now, there may not have been any overt pressure, just the reality that you had Bill Barr coming in as the supervising attorney general, given his track record, given the memo that he had written, perhaps Mueller had just sort of read the writing on the wall and said, I better wrap this up before this guy gets too involved in it. But again, this is all speculation at this point, and you're right. That's going to be the big question, I think, that Congress is going to have to ask and answer.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, there's another school of thought out there, which kind of ties into what you were saying, which is that he could read the writing on the wall, and he wanted to put as much evidence that he'd collected as he possibly could into a report that could then be used as a roadmap before perhaps it did get shut down, extremely prematurely, or before, before there were some threads that he was able to tie up at the time. So this may have been a strategic decision by him. It may have not been because he was completely done. But again, we will find out more once he testifies, if he actually does.
Yeah, to your point, in the section on obstruction of justice, he talks about the possibility of prosecution of the president after he leaves office. And then he makes a comment in the report about the need to memorialize this evidence and to get it on the record when memories were still fresh, which seems to be exactly what you were talking about there. It was like, we're going to get all of this out there, do with it what you will, but I better get it out right now before something bad happens. Natasha Bertrand, thank you so much. And again, you can find her work at Politico. She has been one of the most dogged reporters, in-depth, and you know, analysts of all things Russia, all things Trump. And you can, of course, see her on MSNBC as well. Real pleasure to talk with you, Natasha.
Thanks so much, Charlie, too.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.